Oh, we give thanks. Good morning. My name is Tom Phillips, and I'd like to welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan for this morning's service. As many of us know, UUs have no creed nor requirements for membership. We believe in the liberal ideal that each person find his or her own path. And so we welcome you today via whatever path brought you here. Please join us with an open heart and an open mind. Along those lines, we invite any visitors or guests to sign the guest book that's in the narthex, just to the back of the sanctuary. And I want to draw your attention to the announcements that are in the order of service on the second page and on the back, and there might be something in there of interest. And, of course, I want to invite everyone to join us all together for coffee and conversation after the service in the Alsop room down the hall in the back. Okay. Well, today we have several bits of music, and we're going to start off with an anthem from the choir with a song titled No Time to Diet. And this is an idea that I've been validating every day for the last week. So this morning I've asked Jake to help me by lighting the chalice. And as we have the chalice, please hear these words by Andrew Pakula, "Afraid of the dark. In sightless night, terrors draw near, nameless fears of talon and tooth. Hopelessness yawns before us, an abyss. Alone and unknown in the gloom, longing for the dawn, O sacred flame, blaze forth, wisdom brought to life. Guide us with the light of hope, the warmth of love, the beacon of purpose and meaning, because we are all afraid of the dark. Let there be light." And please stand as you're able for the next hymn, which Michael Oldfather will give some important instructions about. Number 253 in the gray hymnal.
We sing the first verse twice, first in Latin, more or less, as it's written, and then again in English. And there's a long, long tradition of handling the chorus. Venite ad oremus, the sopranos and children sing that. And then the second time we sing it, the altos and tenors join. The third time we sing it, the basses join. That's the way we do it. Okay.
Now is the time in our service when we share those significant joys and sorrows that we carry in our hearts. Please wait for the microphone to come around, and you can so we can all hear. Microphone with Mark.
Hi, Linda Krieger. I just wanted to say goodbye. My husband and I are moving to Lincoln on Tuesday, so our house is full of boxes, and our garbage can is also pretty full. And I want to say thank you, because I am a far better person for having found this fellowship, and I've really appreciated everybody out here. Many of you knew our foster son, Jess. Jess is in Manhattan with another family. He hasn't been real great about texting, but he says he's in a good place. He's still really active in the drama department at the high school, so if any of you attend a play up there, you might run into him. So thanks again. I'll miss you.
Thank you. I tested for my brown belt in Taekwondo, and I went to a Taekwondo Christmas party, and I got my brown belt. And I'm really excited because the next cycle is, our weapon is a bow staff, which is my favorite weapon. So I am just very excited.
Very good. Very good.
And this is Marissa Larson, Jake's mom. And I am very proud of Jake because, as you guys know, since the summer, he's been making and selling survival bracelets to raise money for the Manhattan Emergency Shelter, and the Flint Hills Bread Basket. So we finally counted up all the money yesterday to distribute, and he raised $500.
Hi, I have a sorrow kind of tied to an awareness. I'm a professor at Kansas State University, and over the last week, I've had three students that I personally know attempt suicide. Two of them were hospitalized. One was found an hour away from here, and he's now been admitted to a psychiatric ward. And those are just the students I know. And those students weren't even the ones that I was concerned about. So if, as a member of Manhattan, the Manhattan community, if you could please advocate for better mental health care. Many of these students I send to on campus, and they can't get in because the waiting lists are 2 to 3 weeks long, and it's too late by that point. And this is a really tense time as well because of the larger cultural, you know, issues going on, but also many students have to go back home. And often their identity at home is very different than it is at the university, and that causes a lot of stress. So it's a sorrow. There is happiness in that there was no death, but once again, a sense of awareness for that. So thank you.
I'm Laurel Cross, and I'd like to introduce Beverly and Sabra, our visitors of mine, but Sabra is coming back to Manhattan to work, so that's a joy.
Since Sunday, I have learned the results of the biopsy of this mass in my upper chest. It is malignant. It's called a thymoma, and thoracic surgeon can come back from vacation and or the ski lodge, wherever he's been, in Kansas City. There'll be surgery to remove the thing. If it hasn't invaded any of its neighbors, that will be the end. If it has, then I will be in for radiation therapy. I appreciate how many of you have gone out of your way to say that they hoped I made it, and they seemed sincere. I'm going to assume they are.
I'm Bryce Hobrock, and I see lots of new faces here because this is the first time I've returned in 4.5 months. I had surgery in Kansas City at the end of July, and I've been in recovery mode since then. But I say all of you because in addition to the dozens of you who have come by and have provided food or have otherwise sat with me and tried to convince me there weren't any snakes in the TV, and that I say all of you because this congregation was never far from my mind as the community to which I belong, and I know that every one of you supported me, know me, and no matter what you may have done, your face was always available to my mind, even through the painkillers, and I know that you were a support. I'm pretty close. I'm not anywhere near close to normal, although I can walk 50 feet unaided. I have a walker I use all the time, and I'm sitting in the wheelchair because it's the most comfortable thing for long periods. I had many experiences during my convalescence. Probably the most memorable was when I was invited to address the South Dakota legislature at the request of President Obama, who arrived in South Dakota to greet me. Remember, I was flat on my back and unable to travel during that period. And at any rate, that's the kind of thing that painkillers do to you. And in addition to the snakes and the bats, I've been under the care of good physicians all the way, and I'm not in danger of becoming an addict. The other thing that I must mention is the level of care I've received from Shirley. And as you can imagine, she is the caregiver par excellence. And that you see and the caregiver that I see is one step ahead. The nonsense she's been able to put up with, I don't know how she escaped being a full-time paid caregiver, because she's the best unpaid caregiver you can imagine. No, I actually pay her well. Well, anyway, there are many other hallucinatory experiences that I'll share if you're interested. But this week I've been out several times attending public events, and my stamina is limited, but I said I've got to get up and I've got to go this morning because it's urgent to thank all of you. And it's urgent that this be part of my recovery, which will take probably another year before I'm really in better shape. So thanks to all of you.
Hi, Larry Weaver. This is going to sound like an announcement, but it's really a joy. It refers to what the remarks Shannon made about the need for expanded mental health facilities in our area. On January 10th, there will be a rally in the capital in Topeka called for what's called the Kansas People's Agenda. Many of you, or maybe all of you, will get an email sometime over the next week or so, given the details. But this was a wonderful experience last year in which I got to sit in on a committee hearing and hear just how bad CanCare was a year ago, okay? And then talk with some of our legislators who, in fact, are reasonable Republicans and Democrats and raised taxes to get us started back on the road to fiscal security. I'm high on this, so check your email this week. There may be good news in the offing.
All right. So we honor those joys and sorrows, both spoken and unspoken. And now for more music from the choir. right. So this storybook is named Dusk. Who knows what dusk is? Okay. First hand.
Dusk means late at night or when the sun sets.
When the sun sets, yeah. So what's going on now? I mean, I'll tell you, you know, the days are getting shorter, right? We're almost coming up on the shortest day of the year in a few days, right? I checked my weather app today just to see, and the sun rose at a little after 7:30 this morning, but it's supposed to set starting about 5. So we're at 9 hours of light. So at times like that, people have all different feelings. Sometimes they're kind of blah, it might be sad, but other times they're happy and hopeful. So here's a story about a little boy taking a walk as dusk approaches. And it's winter. Okay? Days are short, nights are long. The boy with a dog and grandfather with the beard, okay, so we got dog boy, grandfather with beard, go for a walk. And when they come to the river, the sun is starting to sink, okay? So this is like the beginning of dusk, you know, when we're heading towards nighttime. It's getting dark, said the boy with the dog. How sad, the day is no more. Dusk, said the grandfather with beard. When they go back to the city, okay, so they're walking back to the city, all the buildings, cars, people are hurrying. Some are going home, others to shop, go shopping this time of year. Here's someone who's shopping, this man with the cane. He says, I swear, I declare, I'll search here and there, I'll search till I find the best of its kind. Toys for my girls and toys for my boys, said the man with cravat, which for your vocabulary today is a pushy tie that's up there, right? Cravat. Anyway. Today's no time for chit-chat, said this woman. Tomatoes, potatoes, and food for my cat, my kitty, my sweetie, my kitty cat, said a woman with a hat. Okay, so she's going shopping. Looks like there's snow there, too. This man says, I'll skip, I'll jump, I'll run, I won't pause, I won't rest till I find the sweetest, the best candies for Mandy and cookies for Randy, said the retired acrobat. So I guess that man used to do acrobatic stuff. Another man looks like a tourist, okay? You see, he's looking at the buildings, and he's got his camera, and then when he starts to speak, it's a little challenging. He says, Dusky musky dusky zat, kahalades ikla zat, sweet kandusky ikla bluski, beddy funny ikla zat. Said the visitor from planet Zataplat. I'm guessing Eastern Europe, but I don't know. Okay. That's kind of weird, yeah. But he's having fun, okay? The buildings grow darker. You see, they're in a city with tall buildings. And the skies are growing dimmer as nature's light goes out. All right? City lights come on. First one. Then others. See them coming on by the buildings. And then even more. It looks like a toy store there, right? There's like toy trains and balls and stuff like that. People are shopping. And more lights. Lights. And we can see some symbols of the holiday. Anybody know what that is?
A menorah.
It's a menorah for Hanukkah. Very good. Anybody know how many candles are there? Well, your turn.
Nine,
that's right. I thought it was 8, but you keep one there to light the others. So that's 9. What other symbol of the season is there? A Christmas tree, yeah. That's right. That's one of the things.
It's coming up.
Yeah, I think so. And there it's dark. What is going, what's being sold there? Jake.
Christmas trees.
They're pretty fresh. They're all wrapped up. And here's one all decorated. There, a beautiful Christmas tree with lighted stars and so forth. And the boy and his grandfather and dog just look at the beautiful things. We got a wintry scene here, and then
Santa,
yeah, on a sleigh with helpers. Yeah, I think they're elves. That's right. Okay, And there's more lights. This is the bookstore where the kids can buy books for the season. There's our menorah again, kids walking around. Lots of lights, so they're feeling pretty good. And then look at this. Look at this heavy, heavy traffic. And there's bookstores, but there's also theaters with people dancing, the Magoose Theater, okay? And it turns out it's Mother Goose's theater. And the boy just raises his hands and looks and says, "It's as light as day." So even though it's dusk, and even though it's getting darker every day, and it's kind of gloomy even today, we can hope for lights. And when sometimes we see lights, it's maybe not what we expected, but it's pretty nice, pretty cool. Okay, we will sing you out now. Go in love,
our hearts so with you. Go in joy, our hopes still true. Learn in love and grow in wisdom. Shine your light in all you do. Go in love, our hearts so with you. Go in joy, our hopes still true. Shine your light in all you do.
And now we will have our offering and hear some music as well. Please stand as you're able to sing our hymn of the month, which is number 55, Dark of Winter.
Thank you.
So now, as a lead into our reflection by Reverend Johnstone, we'll hear two readings from Shannon Skelton.
This is William Faulkner accepting the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1949. I decline to accept the end of humanity. Humanity is immortal because they will endure. When the last ding-dong of doom has clanged and faded from the last worthless rock hanging tideless in the last red and dying evening, even then there will still be one more sound, that of one puny, inexhaustible voice, still talking, saying, "I refuse to accept this." I believe that humanity will not merely endure, it will prevail. We are immortal, not because we alone among creatures has an inexhaustible voice, but because we have a soul, a spirit capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance. The poets, the writer's duty is to write about these things. It is their privilege to help humanity endure by lifting its heart, by reminding them of the courage and honor and hope and pride and compassion and pity and sacrifice which have been the glory of their past. The poet's voice need not merely be the record of humanity. It can be one of the props, the pillars to help them endure and prevail. The second reading is from the film Matrix Revolutions. To kind of explain the context, Agent Smith, an artificial intelligence enforcer of the simulated reality known as the Matrix, is interrogating Neo, a human born with the name David Anderson. And Neo is kind of the one, or the chosen one, to liberate humans from their electronic overlords. Agent Smith says, "Why, Mr. Anderson? Why do you do it? Why get up? Why keep fighting? Do you believe you're fighting for something? For more than your survival? Can you tell me what it is? Do you even know? Is it freedom? Or truth? Perhaps peace? Could it be for love? Illusions, Mr. Anderson, vagaries of perception, the temporary constructs of a feeble human intellect trying desperately to justify an existence that is without meaning or purpose, and all of them as artificial as the Matrix itself. Although only a human mind could invent something as insipid as love. You must be able to see it, Mr. Anderson. You must know it by now. You can't win. It's pointless to keep fighting. Why, Mr. Anderson? Why? Why do you persist?" And to this, Neo replies, "Because I choose to."
So one of the fascinating things about the movies in the Matrix series is the uncertainty around what is reality. If you're not familiar with the Matrix, the premise is that intelligent machines have created a world where humans unknowingly provide energy to keep the machine world going. So that becomes the real world, the machine world, and the people are tricked into believing that they're living a real life. We human beings are easily deceived, it seems. It's a pervasive theme in literature as well as movies. The easy deception of people is part of the premise of Orwell's 1984, a book that many have reread this year. And the understanding goes back as far as Plato's cave in the Republic. Plato introduced us to the idea of people who, chained in a cave and unable to look toward the outside world, saw only shadows and believed that the shadows were reality. So if shadows are all you can see, how can they not be reality? And when one of the captives is freed and finds out there's a whole world out there that they didn't know about, the other prisoners refused to believe him. A couple of weeks ago, I said that one of the things we need to distinguish false hope from true hope is to be able to admit reality. And today, here I am saying that fallible human beings have an awfully hard time knowing what is real. And that's an important preface for looking at the idea of hope in this time of year. Hope that is not grounded in reality is no more than wishful thinking. And this is the time of year for hope, at least according to the Christian calendar, which celebrates faith, hope, love, and joy during Advent. We do it a little differently, as you use, but hope is still a primary focus in December. Frequently in UU congregations, we consider how the time of winter solstice has been celebrated around the world as a ritual of calling back the sun, looking toward the solstice as a moment of hope. We talk about Saturnalia, the Roman festival, and the celebration of the birthday of the unconquerable sun. That's S-U-N, sun. We observe how many ancient people built structures whose features somehow emphasized or used the sun's position at solstice as well, we don't really know what they used it as, but we only know that for some mysterious reason, they considered the sun's winter solstice position important enough to erect whole structures that would focus solstice sunlight in particular ways. We see it in the Egyptian temple of Karnak, the tomb of New Grange in Ireland, and the sun dagger of Chaco Canyon in New Mexico, among other places. Most of what we know about these ancient people's view of solstice is conjecture, if not wild guesses, because they didn't leave written records about it. And we have to recognize the northern bias of so much of the talk of solstice. Australians do not associate winter with Christmas. Anyway, we take that clear interest in solar cycles among the ancients, and we smush together different holidays that seem to have something to do with light: Diwali in India, Hanukkah among Jews, Nebutsu in Japan, solstice. We read them all as sun-worshipping rites, connected somehow with bonfires built on hills in Britain and torches raised to Mithra in Persia. So here are words from a ceremony written by Ken Patton, mid-20th century UU minister, whose enthusiasm for the artistry of liturgy shaped our UU celebrations of the season. He wrote, "Beneath all midwinter festivals is our dependence upon the warmth and light of the sun, and fear for the power of the sun in the short, darkened days of winter solstice. The sun was one of the earliest of all the gods." And while those words are likely true as far as they go, they can encourage and support a style of universalism that blends differences into oblivion and creates an alternate reality as strong as the Matrix. A woman I knew who grew up UU rolls her eyes remembering the midwinter festival of her church used to put on, where everything felt kind of mushed together. She recalled playing the mother of Buddha, scoffing because it felt like overreach. Some part of the recognition of changing seasons in December, looking toward an increase in light, is real, of course, at least here in the Northern Hemisphere. The days do grow shorter until that moment of solstice when they once again grow longer. Our lives do rely on the sun. Still, even now, as much as we might try to deny it with our electric lights and oil-powered lifestyles, without the sun, no food, no warmth, no human existence. That remains a reality. The questionable part, the human-created part of winter solstice is the whole business about hope in the darkness, the tiny flame growing into great light, and particularly framing darkness and light as opposing forces that fight for supremacy and are associated implicitly, if not explicitly, with good and evil. These ideas do not rest in some shared universal human consciousness. They have a particular source. And I think it's safe to say that they come from Zoroastrianism. Zoroaster, also called Zarathustra, the prophet who created that once popular religion, was probably born somewhere around 1,000 years before Jesus in Persia. And he instituted his religion as monotheistic, but it evolved into a strongly dualistic faith centered on that struggle between good and evil, between light and dark. And Zoroastrianism also posited a strong distinction between the material and the spiritual realms. Though once a widespread and powerful religion, Zoroastrians worldwide today are outnumbered even by Unitarians and Universalists. The Parsis of India may be best known of today's surviving Zoroastrians, though the religion does still survive on its home turf in Iran. But at its height, it spread across the ancient world, touching Greece and Rome and India, and had significant influence, particularly over Judaism and later Christianity and Islam. And among the ideas that influenced the Abrahamic faiths were concepts of the afterlife, such as heaven and hell, the wait for a Messiah, Armageddon, angels and demons, and even the importance of individual free will. All of these things come out of Zoroastrianism. And none of them are fundamental to the Abrahamic faiths. They are clearly imported. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that one of the traditional interpretations of the Magi, of the Christmas story, the wise men, is that they were Zoroastrians. Now, I'm not giving this background in order to try to separate out legitimate Christian ideas from illegitimate imported ones. Of course, people have always learned from one another and adopted one another's ideas and interpretations of the world. It's led often to worldviews that are inconsistent, if not downright messy, but that's where we are. But the point I want to make is that concepts and worldviews have an origin. What may seem to us to be true and useful, even obvious, may simply be a pervasive habit of thought, a reality to which we have become accustomed, not unlike the Matrix. How may those ideas have influenced us without our own knowledge and shaped aspects of reality that we didn't expect and sometimes don't even know that they're there because they are unconscious? So one of the unexpected influences of dualistic views of light and dark lives on in our thinking about race. It's so pervasive in our language that it often goes unexamined. And it's a particular danger this time of year. So the retired UU religious educator Jackie James, who's an African American who has worked tirelessly on racial justice issues, wrote a reflection entitled Dark and Light that I'd like to share with you. Blackmail, blacklist, black mark, Black Monday, black mood, black-hearted, black plague, black mass, black market. Good guys wear white, bad guys wear black. We fear black cats and the dark continent. But it's okay to tell a white lie. Lily white hands are coveted. It's great to be pure as the driven snow. Angels and brides wear white. Devil's food cake is chocolate. Angel food cake is white. We shape language and we are shaped by it. In our culture, white is esteemed. It is heavenly, sun-like, clean, pure, immaculate, innocent, and beautiful. At the same time, black is evil, wicked, gloomy, depressing, angry, sullen. Ascribing negative and positive values to black and white enhances the institutionalization of this culture's racism. Let us acknowledge the negative connotations of whiteness. White things can be soft, vulnerable, pallid, and ashen. Light can be blinding, bleaching, enervating. Conversely, we must acknowledge that darkness has a redemptive character, that in darkness there's power and beauty. The dark nurtured and protected us before our birth. Welcome darkness. Don't be afraid of it or deny it. Darkness brings relief from the blinding sun, from scorching heat, from exhausting labor. Night signals permission to rest, to be with our loved ones, to conceive new life, to search our hearts, to remember our dreams. The dark of winter is a time of hibernation. Seeds grow in the dark, fertile earth. The words black and dark don't need to be destroyed or ignored, only balanced and reclaimed in their wholeness. The words white and light don't need to be destroyed or ignored, only balanced and reclaimed in their wholeness. Imagine a world that had only light or dark. We need both. Dark and light. Light and dark. So the understanding of light that Jackie James suggests acknowledges contrast, but dismisses the competitive struggle, the battle between light and dark, the battle bequeathed to us thousands of years ago. Once you've seen these influences, you can't unsee them. Zoroaster could not have known how his drawing of those lines would have played out. Sheldon Cheek of the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research explains that in medieval times, Christian art depicted demonic forces as dark-colored, but they didn't associate them with African bodies. Now, late medieval art introduced African figures, including the beautiful Queen of Sheba and one of the wise men. They traditionally made one of the wise men African, but without any implications of evil. Gradually, though, the dark skin of demons becomes associated with that of Africans. And as Cheek writes, by the time of the slave trade, the general equivalence of darkness to evil had further shifted to the assumed ethnic inferiority of Africans within the more concrete context of enlightened science and trade. So the use of that word enlightened, or the idea of the time of enlightenment, further makes the point that darkness has negative connotations, something that must be overcome by the light of reason, the light of science. I want to say a little more about the artistic images. We find an example of how artistic images and cultural images play out in Black Pete. Do you know Black Pete? This has been a huge controversy in the Netherlands. Black Pete is a mythic figure of the European lowlands who accompanies Santa Claus on his rounds. And actually, it's several black assistants working with Santa Claus. And Black Pete first appeared in the middle of the 19th century as a Moor from Spain. However, he harkens back to medieval portrayals of St. Nicholas with a dark-colored chained demon. Now, If Cheek is correct, such a demon would not have been seen in medieval times as an African. Yet something of the demon image lurks behind the 19th century development of Sinterklaas's black assistants, who initially were likely understood as slaves. And despite decades of denial of racist connections, it was just earlier this year that an Amsterdam court ruled that Black Pete is a negative stereotype. And so, this Christmas season, many Dutch people are seeing Pete in a variety of colors, including yellow and striped. That's kind of interesting. Ideas about the distinctions between black and white travel through our culture in such seemingly innocent ways, yet they shape or distort our views of the world, our understanding of reality. So, where's the hope in all this? And the title of this reflection, after all, is Longing for Hope. The traditional image at this time of year is sitting in the darkness, a place of despair and barrenness, longing for the return of light which brings goodness and cheer. The light of reason, the spark of inspiration, the candle is a symbol of hope. And I've been trying to talk about this other side of it so that we can maybe reframe that in some ways. We make these associations carelessly, unconcerned with lingering implications they leave in our unconscious thoughts. In some ways, we create the world we imagine, and I don't mean this to be an absolute statement. We cannot use this as a device to try to deny what's real. What I know about the working of hope, though, is this. There is hope when we can imagine something better and move toward it. And when we cannot imagine something better, there's nowhere for us to go. We are then lost in despair. So imagination matters. And that's what Longfellow saw when he wrote the words to the anthem the choir sang earlier. At first, in hearing the bells, he felt despair. In despair, I turned my head. There is no peace on earth, I said. For hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to all. Can you sympathize with that? Have you been there? I have. The listening to the bells. He kept listening to the bells, and then he could imagine a living God who restored hope. It's one of my personal favorite Christmas hymns. It is my personal favorite. It's the top. And it doesn't require a faith in God to turn things around, though. We heard the same imagination in the readings this morning. William Faulkner, in the wake of the Second World War, refused despair, finding hope in the human soul, as he described it, a spirit capable of compassion and sacrifice and endurance. The poet's voice, he said, need not merely be the record of humanity. It can be one of the props, the pillars, to help them endure and prevail. The poets and writers supply that pillar of hope because they're engaged in imagination. That imagination can face the challenges, a source of hope in the poet's imagination. And similarly, Neo of The Matrix makes a choice to persist and to fight because he can imagine an alternative, something better than being stuck in service to the machine, something worthy of the human spirit. I felt some hope, too, this week in electoral politics. Maybe someone else did. I think Alabama voters were presented with a clear choice to look to the past or to the future. And voters, particularly black voters, imagined a future that could be different. There's hope in that. So human beings, we human beings, are gullible, yes. We easily accept realities that have been given that are not or need not be entirely real. We have accepted that dark is bad and light is good. On the other hand, we have imagination and can turn that on its head. We can change our minds, redeem our language, salvage our symbols, and reconsider them. That is our hope, or at least part of it. And so if there are thoughts on hope that you wish to share, I'd give you a few minutes to do that.
One of my favorite physicists is Steven Weinberg. And at the end of a book about the first 3 minutes of the universe, he said, the more we learn about the universe, the more pointless it seems. And this created, as you might imagine, quite a flood of mail for the man. And in thinking about that, I think it is true that the laws of nature don't show us any point to the world. But we, with our imagination, can create meaning. We create the points of hope. And let's pray that we make the sacrifices and make the decisions to not change the climate quite so much, so that Faulkner's vision of people even enduring can come true.
So I think your major point in your sermon today is a really critically important one, because we are, as a species, facing tremendous challenges of our own making, the cataloging of which is not needed, I think, for this group. But the only way to overcome those challenges is to have hope, I think.
It's a situation where if we don't see hope, there's nothing that we work toward. And so we have to come to that hope, and I think that we can.
Diane Barker. Hope is a very strange word to me, because I kind of frame it that it only has meaning if you accept reality, that it has to be based on what's really happening. Otherwise, it's a fantasy. And I appreciate the recognition that our imaginations have created this, what we're in. So we can get out of it, but you don't fix your problems with the same sort of thinking.
So Jody Hendon, This time of year, depression can be a really big hope drainer. And so, like, for myself and other people who suffer from, you know, seasonal affective, even if it's just for a few weeks, it can be a really big deal. And so, you know, the need to reach out at this time of year to, you know, whether you're affected or whether you see other people who are, can be wonderful for improving other people and their sense of hope and their ability to make it through a season where darkness isn't necessarily, because of the lack of light or whatever, you know, isn't always the greatest thing for them, and to help them to appreciate, you know, what they do have.
Okay. I share these words in praise of darkness, O holy darkness, loving womb, by Jan Aldridge Clanton. O holy darkness, loving womb, who nurtures and creates, sustain us through the longest night with dreams of open gates. We move inside to mystery that in our center dwells, where streams of richest beauty flow from sacred living wells. Creative darkness, closest friend, you whisper in the night. You calm our fears as unknown paths surprise us with new sight. We marvel at your bounty, your gifts so full and free, unfolding as you waken us to new reality. O holy night of deepest bliss, we celebrate your power. Infuse us with your energy that brings our seeds to flower. The voice out of the darkness excites our warmest zeal to bring together dark and light, true holiness reveal. Oh, come to us, Sophia, your image, black and fair, stirs us to end injustice and the wounds of earth repair. The treasures of your darkness and riches of your grace inspire us to fulfill our call, our sacredness embrace. So may it be. Amen.
We are performers, and we love Paul. But this might be a situation where your silence would honor us even more.
Day in and out, wait weary tasks, burdens we lift, worn paths we wear some more. Want and means, worn thin and fatigue, pain and grief, coldness of heart, bitter and weary days, where we know desolation, how do we call forth hope? When our hearts buried, sunken down, how do we dig out, rise up? What healing touch do we long for? What balm might we take and share? Come what may, O Spirit of life, may we keep a ray of light for our inward path, a living water in the depths of us, a cleansing breath at our core. May we keep them for ourselves and to share. May we call forth from each other vitality and tenacity. May love rest in us. May justice live through us. May we have the touch to call others back to life and love, justice and peace. May we sing back their songs and add the alleluias. In the Spirit, by the Spirit, with the Spirit giving power. So may it be. Amen.